Welcome all to the Senate Energy and Utilities Policy and Finance Committee. It is Thursday, February 24th, 3:05 in the afternoon. We're here today to hear from Xcel Energy. They recently had their resource plan, if you will, integrated resource plan approved by the Public Utilities Commission. And that's a major initiative, and certainly a major approval once you get it approved. And so we're here to find out what that plan is and how it might affect policy in Minnesota and certainly practice in Minnesota going forward. So we have Farah Mandich, who works on this initiative at Xcel Energy, and of course our old friend Rick Evans, who we all know and love and hangs around this place and keeps Xcel's energies, interests in mind at all times. So, Farah, if you want to introduce yourself and start, we certainly can do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Farah Mandich, and I'm the Director of Resource Planning at Xcel Energy for their Upper Midwest service area. So I am just going to share my screen quickly. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you today about our recently approved...
Farah, can I just interrupt you? These mics are kind of hug your mic as close as you can.
Okay.
It helps everybody hear.
Is that better?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
I might remind you, though, so...
Okay. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak to you today about our recently approved integrated resource plan. In this presentation, I'm going to give you an overview of what a resource plan is and how we conduct this process. We'll talk a little bit about the highlights of the plan that we proposed. We'll give you an overview of the specific plan elements the Public Utilities Commission recently approved. And we'll talk a little bit at the end about what happens next as we look forward to achieving on the MPUC's order and planning for our next IRP. So first, we'll talk a little bit about what a resource plan is and how we conduct it. The company's resource planning process is sort of a roadmap for what type of energy generation resources we will use, either build or procure through contracts, to serve customers over the next 15 years. And when we do this planning, at least in our area, we plan for the whole Upper Midwest service area as one big system. So we're planning both for NSP Minnesota and NSP Wisconsin together. It covers, like I said, it covers 15 years, with the first 5 years being the primary focus because those are the things that we need to take near-term action on. And then the next 10 years are generally more directional, but do provide a helpful guideline for what our plan might look like in the future. And we file one of these plans approximately every 2 to 3 years. So that gives us many chances to reevaluate our plans and check in with the regulators on the path forward that we've proposed.
Farah, may I just ask?
Yes.
You said file a plan. So you file a plan. I can understand you file a plan. Do you go to the PUC then back and re-explain your plan every 2 or 3 years?
Yes.
Or
that's
just a filing?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's correct. So we... after we finish our modeling and kind of all of the planning requirements that we have to put in that regulatory filing, we will submit it to the Public Utilities Commission, and then there's a very long stakeholder process that it goes through when we file it. So generally, at least the last few resource plans have taken a couple of years to get all the way through the process from filing to approval, and then every kind of 2 years or a year and a half after that is when we would file the next one.
Okay, thank you.
Yes. So just to talk a little bit about what we're trying to achieve when we design one of these plans, there are really four core planning objectives that we work to achieve. And the first one is cost. So cost is really the primary factor we're balancing. Everything we do in our planning process is examined through the lens of one potential plan's future costs relative to the business as usual case or another potential plan that we might be evaluating. And so comparing our proposed plan or other side cases to the business as usual case really helps us evaluate the costs over a long period of time and make sure that we're keeping customer bills as low as practicable when we're choosing our preferred plan. The secondary goal I will highlight is we're also planning to meet environmental goals. And these goals could be either policy or regulatory requirements set forth by the legislature or our commission, or they could be our own carbon reduction goals. And so in this case, for this IRP, this is the first plan that we've done since we announced our 80 by 30 goals to reduce our carbon 80% from 2005 levels by 2030. And so really what we were aiming to do for this plan is try to find a path forward that would allow us to meet those carbon reduction goals. The third objective that I will highlight is reliability. We take reliability very seriously. Reliability is a table stakes objective for a utility. We have to be sure that we have enough resources on our system to serve customer needs every hour of every day. And we also plan our system to be sure that we're meeting resource adequacy obligations for our regional market operator, MISO. And finally, the last objective that I will highlight is risk mitigation. And this is somewhat related to reliability, but it's slightly different, where we're really working to manage market exposure for customers and maintain portfolio diversity to make sure that we have a lot of different types of fuel sources we're using to serve our customers. One way we examine the risk or robustness of a particular plan is by looking at various sensitivities. So we test different commodity prices, different gas, coal, market electricity prices. We test different levels of customer demand that we might incur in the future, and many other factors, technology costs, to see if our plans are beneficial, even if those cost and technology factors might move around a little bit from where we were forecasting them when we designed the plan. So when we go through the planning process, we take into account many different inputs. Some of them I just mentioned, commodity costs, technology costs, customer demand. We also, you know, for customer demand, we look at what their overall energy consumption would be. We also examine whether they're adopting energy efficiency or, for example, rooftop solar at their houses, because that reduces the amount that we would need to procure on their behalf. We're looking at resource technology costs and operating capabilities, both of the resources that are already on our system and what would be available to us to add as a new resource, recognizing that each resource brings a different set of attributes to our system that can be beneficial working together. We take into account compliance with policy and regulatory requirements, of course, and then we also take into account a fairly large volume of stakeholder input and feedback, and I'll talk a little bit about that later in the presentation as well. So when we have all of these inputs, we take all of those into account as we're developing essentially an economic model. We put all of those inputs into basically a computer model that conducts cost-benefit analysis for us. And so when we design each plan, we're looking at the cost of one plan over the long term relative to costs of a different plan over the long term, comparing and contrasting the benefits and costs of each plan and trying to select the one that we feel best serves customers in the future. After we vet these potential future generation portfolios internally, we select a preferred plan, as I mentioned, and that's at that point, after we select that preferred plan, we would file a document with the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission that describes our process of getting to that plan and how we think that plan is beneficial for customers going forward. After we submit that plan, we go through a very lengthy stakeholder process. This time, it took approximately 2.5 years to move through the full process. During that stakeholder process, Various parties will read over our plan. They'll ask us questions. Sometimes they do their own modeling using our inputs or modifications to our inputs, and offer formal comments on our plan through the regulatory process. And at the end of that stakeholder process, we have a hearing where the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission considers all the input that both we and other parties have provided and makes a decision on what we should implement over the next 5 to 10 years, recognizing that we will reevaluate the latter year decisions in our next IRP. So I'll stop there. Is there any questions on the process part before I move on?
Any questions of our witness? None now, so continue on, please.
Great, thank you.
Nice job.
Thank you.
You're very helpful.
So now we'll talk a little bit, now that we've talked about how the plan's developed, we'll talk a little bit about what we proposed. At a high level, there are four key components of this plan. The first is closing all of our coal plants a decade ahead of schedule while providing a reasonable off-ramp to ensure reliability and transition our workforce. This plan in particular proposed to close the King coal plant in 2028 and the Sherco 3 plant in 2030. The second pillar of the plan is adding renewables. Our plan proposes to add approximately 5,800 megawatts of renewable capacity through 2034. And by 2030, more than half of our energy will come from these resources. The third pillar of the plan is continuing operation of our 24/7 carbon-free energy nuclear units. This plan maintains reliance on carbon-free and reliable nuclear energy by extending the life of the Monticello plant out to 2040. And then the last pillar I will note is enabling a carbon-free future. So this plan also includes what we call firm dispatchable units that we believe are essential to maintaining the reliability and stability of our system over the long term, while ensuring that we can integrate high levels of renewable energy onto our grid. These units in our plan are CTs, those are gas combustion turbines, which are available to ramp up and operate for long periods of time if renewable availability on our system is low. We also envision them in the future to be able to run on lower carbon or carbon-free fuel. So they're very, in that sense, they're flexible, and we're planning for the future to be able to operate them even in a lower carbon future.
Ms. Madge, tell me when I get into a sort of a privileged question, but so you did not mention the Prairie Island plant, but extending the Monticello plant's life can you speak to the Prairie Island plant's future?
Yes, thank you for that question, Mr. Chair. We did consider a scenario that extended the Prairie Island plant as well, and we did find that to be beneficial from an economics perspective. Having said that, I know that we have a lot more stakeholder work to do with the local communities in that area, and so we wanted to preserve the option of proposing an extension to that plant in the future. But we did not propose it in this IRP. We're going to, I think, evaluate that further in our next plan.
Okay, thank you.
So in addition to these four pillars, the last thing I'll mention about the plan that we proposed at this point is that we also plan to work on expanding our successful energy efficiency programs and demand response programs to lower our overall energy and load during peak times. So all of these things work together to create what we feel is a cost-effective, well-balanced plan.
Ms. Madden, can I just maybe follow up on my question? So the implication then is unless a reversal of the decision relative to Monticello, that will close at some point in the 2040s. Is that a truism, at least as we sit here today?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. We've proposed to extend it to 2040. The plant still has at least two more regulatory processes it needs to work through before we can say that for sure. The first is that we have a certificate of need filed before the Public Utilities Commission at this point to ask them to approve expanding the fuel storage at the site, which will be necessary to operate the plant for longer than its current license. And then the license also has to be extended by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission at the federal government. So working through the processes for both of those, either currently or in the, over the next few years we will be.
Thank you. And Mr. Evans, perhaps, or maybe you can answer, will a future legislature be at all involved in any of these decisions, or are they all at the regulatory level?
Mr. Chair and members, under current law, if we apply for a certificate of need to expand the spent fuel storage, and the PUC gives us an order to allow us to do that, that order is stayed for 1 year, which was designed so the legislature would meet at least once before the order became final. If the legislature does nothing, then the order will become final, but it gives the legislature the opportunity to act on the additional storage if they want to. That was the, I can't remember exactly when the last time we addressed this. I want to say something like 2007, and that was the decision of the legislature was that we would allow the PUC order to take effect, but we would delay it 1 year so the legislature would have a chance to act if they wanted to.
Thank you so much. Anybody have any follow-up? Okay, please continue.
Thank you. So in terms of what our plan achieves on an environmental basis, we can see here that our system energy mix is already quite clean. We get 62% of our energy currently as of 2020 from carbon-free resources. And that's approximately half nuclear and half renewables and other carbon-free resources. As we implement this plan, we are projecting that we would be able to get to 80% carbon-free resources by 2030. And that would include those same nuclear resources as well as an expansion of wind and solar. Observed another way, we see here that our plan significantly reduces our emissions relative to our baseline 2005 levels, achieving over 85% carbon reduction by 2030. And so we feel that this plan puts us on a path not only to achieve our 2030 carbon reduction goals, but also our ultimate goal at 2050 of achieving 100% carbon-free energy at that point. Before I move ahead from these slides, I do want to reiterate one important point here. Although we don't show it on these slides, it's important to keep in mind that we're always examining these portfolios through an economic lens and balancing the environmental goals that we have with cost, reliability, and risk mitigation. The plan that underlies these carbon reduction trajectories achieves our goals at a lower cost in the long run than our business as usual plan, both when considering the impact of environmental externality pricing and in cases where those externality prices are not factored in. So now I will talk a little bit about the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission recent decision approving our plan with some modifications and additional requirements. As I mentioned previously, we started this process in 2018, actually, with nearly 15 stakeholder workshops. We received over 1,000 information requests in this docket and 8,000 or more public comments in the docket. So there was a lot of public participation in this process. At the end of January and early February, the MPUC held hearings and issued their decision that adopted many of the recommended decision points we worked together with the clean energy organizations and labor organizations to develop. Some of the key elements of the MPUC approved order include that proposed extension of the Monticello nuclear unit to 2040. As I mentioned before, there are subsequent regulatory processes that need to play out before we officially move forward with that license extension, but we are in the process of either having filed those with the Minnesota Commission or we will be filing the federal ones in the coming years. Our plan also includes, as I mentioned, retiring all of our coal plants by 2030, and the commission approved that. They also, however, required that we continue stakeholder engagement with the host communities of these plants and account for workforce transition considerations. We will also be pursuing coal site transition through two approved new transmission lines that go out from our Sherco and King sites. And these will allow us to reutilize valuable interconnection rights at those sites to connect new resources to the grid. And both of these transmission lines will also undergo additional regulatory proceedings and approvals in the years to come. Another point of our plan is, like I said, adding a significant amount of renewables. This includes doubling the amount of solar resources we have on our system by 2026. And many of the new wind, solar, and storage resources indicated here will be placed on the transmission lines that reutilize the Sherco and King interconnection rights. I will note that, importantly, the Commission did recognize that we have a need for firm dispatchable resources that will keep the system reliable. Currently, we're planning to locate these resources in North Dakota and southern Minnesota, but we will have additional regulatory proceedings to determine both the technology type and the location for this capacity. There's additional direction that the Commission issued to us regarding the resource acquisition processes we will use to actually acquire the new wind, solar, firm dispatchable storage units that I highlighted. And these are really designed to ensure fair and competitive bidding and that the best technologies to fit the needs of the system will be evaluated. And then finally, the MPUC is requiring significant further stakeholder efforts ahead of our next IRP. These include vetting the modeling inputs that I discussed at the beginning of the presentation, working further with host communities, labor, and workers, and considering environmental justice and equity in our decisions. So what comes next? The MPUC will issue its written order over the coming weeks, and after that happens, we will initiate several new regulatory processes surrounding the renewable additions, the transmission lines, and the firm dispatchable resources indicated in the order. We will also establish several stakeholder groups and begin working toward our next IRP filing, which is due on February 1st of 2024. And with that, I will thank you again for the opportunity to speak to you, and I'm happy to take any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Ms. Mandage. Mr. Evans, do you have any follow-up at this point? Just here for questions.
No, Mr. Chair, thank you.
Okay. Any questions? Senator Utke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And question for you, as you explained this plan, but as we look at electricity, two things that typically come to mind are affordability and reliability. I don't see it. Shutting down these coal plants and looking at these renewables, and it says and or some storage. Today, right now, 89.4% of our electrical load on the MISO grid was coal, natural gas, and nuclear. Wind and solar was 9.4%. That's a long ways to go in a short period of time. I guess it's more of a comment, but I just don't see how it's going to work and still keep the lights on when people flip the switch and expect things to happen. This morning up north, of which that isn't in your territory, but again, it was 31 below. Everything's running. So it's a big concern for me anyhow.
Ms. Mandage.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Magic?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator. Thank you for that comment, and I very very clearly understand that concern. That's something we take very seriously in our planning process. We take that into account in multiple ways, and I can list a couple of things. So in our economic models, the first way we evaluate this is that the MISO gives us planning directives when we do our plans. So we have to maintain what's called a planning reserve margin, which is making sure that we have enough capacity to serve our customer load plus a buffer so that we don't sort of run out of capacity. And so that's taken into account when we do our plans. Our model evaluates our system. It simulates our electricity system on an hourly basis. And so that is a good way to ensure that the model doesn't allow, essentially, we make sure that the model is not choosing a set of resources that would result in a shortfall for customer needs. So we're always making sure that on an hourly basis, meeting the customer load that we have on our system. I think the third thing I'll mention is that, you know, we recognize that there are periods of time where renewables are not available for several hours in even days. And we had lengthy discussions with that on that topic at the Utilities Commission. There were several parties that disagreed with us that we needed new gas CT resources to fill that need. We still believe that gas CTs are the best resource suited to make sure that we can integrate that level of renewables while maintaining reliability. And so ultimately the commission decided that they agreed that we did have a firm dispatchable need, that we had a need for resources that can dispatch over long periods of time when renewables are not available. But they did decline to determine exactly what technology will be well suited for that by the time we need to build the plant. And that's really our role, that we have to prove out, if we're gonna build a gas plant, why we think that's the best one to build. And that we've evaluated all of the alternatives and that we're making the best decision on behalf of customers.
Can you follow up? Yes.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And of course, the electricity that you produce or buy, it goes onto the grid and then you pull it back off. We see what's on the grid, but because of what you're trying to put on the grid, are you using the grid to kind of level out the peaks and the valleys of what you would really get from your renewables here? I mean, we can talk a good story and sell it to the PUC, but it's not really what the customer's getting. They're relying on the grid to level this out and make sure they have reliable service. Is the way I see it, is that true, or am I kind of reading it right? We can use the whole system to kind of help accomplish and sound good, but yet, well, I'll just say it, it levels it out.
Ms. Mandridge?
Mr. Chair and Senator, yes, in reality, that's correct. When all of the resources that we have on our system that we either contract or own to serve customers ultimately do go into the MISO system, and then we purchase energy from the MISO system to serve customers. So in a sense, it's correct that the market broadly helps every utility in the market, every load-serving entity in the market, balance out. However, I would say that an important part of our planning process is what MISO would call fixed resource adequacy planning, which means that we're always planning to have enough capacity to meet our own customers' system needs as if we were an island. So that's taken into account in our planning process. Even though we do interact with the market, we're always making sure that we have enough capacity specifically contracted or owned to serve our own customer load.
Okay, so I have Senator Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Mandich and Mr. Evans, for being here and sharing today. Have a couple of things that I want to ask about from your presentation. And I guess I'll hit the biggest one first that has jumped out at me as I've reviewed this. I do not understand how an approved plan includes, as a bullet point that you include on page 9 of your slides, that you have 800 megawatts of firm dispatchable resources needed in the future, yet to be determined. I don't understand how we get a plan presented with a TBD in it and have that approved. I actually have a suggestion if Excel is open to how we fill that gap. An 800 megawatt natural gas plant in Becker that the company just walked away from after years of working for that. But I'd like some more information on that and what that means and what the intent is to fill that gap. And then I will have a couple more questions, Mr. Chair.
Sure. Ms. Mandich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator. We would agree that it's necessary to have at least 800 megawatts of firm dispatchable resources on the system at that time. And we do at this point think the best technology to serve that need are gas resources. Having said that, when we reevaluated our plan, we examined whether there's a business as usual case, which is all of the resources online through their current retirement dates, and that did include the plant in Becker. The initial plan that we proposed to retire the coal plants early, extend Monticello, and that also included the plant, the CC in Becker. And then based on significant stakeholder pushback, frankly, from every side, nearly every side, we felt we needed to evaluate a plan that did not include that CC and evaluated whether there were other resources that could meet that need and do that in a more affordable way. And that is what we ultimately found, that that alternative plan that we evaluated third would be the most cost-effective way to meet needs while still ensuring the reliability of our system. Like I said, we do believe that gas CTs are the best way to meet that need. We'll have to prove that out in future regulatory filings with the commission.
Senator Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that leads into my next point. I do have to disagree with the characterization that almost every side disagreed with the gas plant. There was a very strong side in support in our host community, in the surrounding area, by a lot of people that recognize the need of that reliability that would have on the grid. And your slides have things in here about listening to stakeholders and valuing the feedback that you get and all of that. But what happened in action only seemed to be valuing the feedback of one particular side and completely ignoring the feedback from the other side, from our host communities and what we were pushing for here. So I appreciate some of the language that is listed here in some of the slides. I just don't see the actions that back it up. I don't know if you can point to something that was in that's in the plan now that is still there as a result of the host communities and the pro-gas people that were pushing for the plant to go through as was originally intended. Just to give a bit of a background to the committee members and to those listening, I was first made aware, Mr. Evans informed me last year about this alternate plan that was now in the works, and that, well, it's still just the alternate plan. We still have the preferred plan. Becker is still the preferred plan, but we've decided, based on feedback, that we're going to make this alternate plan. And I said, you're going to come to me someday and tell me that the plans have switched and the alternate plan's the preferred plan and the preferred plan is the alternate plan, won't you? And you remember, Mr. Evans, you said, that's not our plan at this point, in at least so many words. And unfortunately, sometime later, that exactly came true. We came and had to break the unfortunate news that the alternate plan was now the preferred plan, and the preferred plan is now jettisoned. And so the communities having to work through that, you know, we had a pretty targeted several years ago, about even before I came into the legislature here, there is a pretty targeted response negatively against the coal plants that are there at Becker. And I believe the gas plant was in agreement with many of those groups we'll work on shutting these coal plants down and put gas in its stead because we need some form of reliability here. And no sooner was the ink dry on that before the turnaround came and the gas plant there was now in those sites. So now we've taken a step beyond even further. Now the Becker gas plant is gone. There will be, my understanding is, two small gas plants in western Minnesota and maybe even pushing into the Dakotas. And I feel like it's going to get chased step by step by step until it's outside of our state boundaries. And they'll get the jobs and they'll get the tax revenue. And they'll still ship the same power here into Minnesota. We can pat ourselves on the back for having a really high renewable standard here in Minnesota, but we'll still be using baseload energy, and we won't be getting any of the jobs or the revenue off of it. Senator Rutke kind of beat me to the punch a little bit because I pulled up the MISO fuel mix from today. and the total numbers, and I know I assume the slide that you show is the Excel generation numbers, and that's going to look differently from the MISO generation numbers, but this is what it takes for powering our whole region that MISO serves. And right now, today, solar is providing all of 0.8% of the total fuel mix for today, February 24th, 2022. Wind is about at 5% right now. Coal is providing 44% of the electricity, helping keep these lights on and keeping our houses warm right now today as we speak. Gas is right behind it at 33%, nuclear at 14%. I'm just concerned with the push onto the combined 5.8% is going to be the new model that that much of your company is going to base it on, and there's a severe downturn and ramping down in the 77 plus 14, the 91% of the mix that provides our baseload energy right now. And so I want to echo some of those concerns. I think the discussion about, you know, trying to take feedback seriously has not played out in how at least my side, the side that, you know, my community that I represent, felt that the process played out. I think it's going to be tough to sell that you, as you indicated, you try to keep bills as low as practicable. Not long after you announced the alternate plan got approved or was going to be approved, you came along very quickly afterward and came to the commission and said, we need a 20% rate increase over the next 3 years. I have the feeling that going down this plan, we're probably gonna need to have more of those rate increases to make up the difference down the road, 5 and 10 years from now. That's just my hunch as I'm sitting here from my vantage point. So some of those I want to share. I'm obviously going to continue to encourage the company to get back on track with, I think the fuel mix and the energy needs to actually have the proof in the numbers that we'll have the reliability, the affordability, the clean energy standard that you're trying to meet. And it hasn't seemed that that's been accomplished in this plan or the process we've gone through so far. So kind of a ramble, Mr. Chair. I apologize for that. If there's anything you want to answer to that, I'm fine for that. But that's sure. Just some of my comments. Thank you.
Ms. Mandage, any follow-ups to that or Mr. Evans?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No. I don't have any follow-up to that. The feedback is well taken.
Mr. Chair, I guess the only thing I would add, and I've had a lot of conversations with Senator Matthews about this, and he's recounted those fairly and accurately, I think, over the last couple of years. What I'd ask the committee to look at is the process that we go through, including all of the input that comes in, and it is considered, but at the end of the day, you know, the Public Utilities Commission issues the order, and you know, that's the process that we have and that we go through. So that's not, you know, I don't want to be defensive about it. It's the way the public utilities work. And I understand, I understand the difficulties of the people in Becker and what, you know, this has brought about for them. And it's still the process that we have.
Yes, Senator Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And real quickly, if you'd confirm, Mr. Evans, talking about the PUC approval process, it's true, though, at the end of the day, a plan for building the Becker gas plant was never presented to the Public Utilities Commission by the time you got to the final filings for approval. Is that the case? Can you clarify that?
Mr. Evans? Or?
Sure. Maybe just to clarify, it was presented in the original plan and was included in the plan, you know, through much of the process. I think I would, you know, I would compare this process similar to, you know, something I'm familiar with in my former life, you know, litigation. You go in and you battle and you have a jury or you have a judge, but at some point, sometimes the parties have to sit down and say, you know, we need to resolve this. And so at the point, as Ms. Mandich explained, after we had done modeling and saw that the two CTs were in some way superior to the Becker CC, based on our modeling, that, you know, that became that was when we shifted the plan, as you described earlier. So, you know, it's not true that it wasn't presented to them, and I know you know that, but it was, by the time they got to the final decision, we had moved off of that plan and we were presenting the other plan.
Mr. Chair,
yes, Senator.
And I guess and you're correct, Mr. Evans, and I guess what I'm saying is by the end there, it wasn't that the two plans were there at the PUC to choose between at the end. At the end there for the final decision, only the alternate plan was the one presented to them. That's correct?
That's correct. Yeah.
So I, just to follow up so I understand, if I could, either Mr. Evans or Ms. Mandich. So the Becker gas plant was in the so-called initial filing, and then we have the meetings and maybe ultimately the hearing. I don't know if this was decided ahead of the hearing or at the hearing or in conjunction with the hearing processes. I don't remember days they took, but so at some point then before the final approval, the decision was made that the approval would not include the Becker gas site, but would include a couple of other sites somewhere in Minnesota, also burning natural gas, right? Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay.
I can describe the process a little bit further if that would
sure.
be helpful.
But would be to me because I think it's important for us.
Yep. So we filed our initial plan in 2019, as I mentioned. That plan did include, it included the Becker CC. It included a plan to retire the coal plants early, and it included a proposal to extend the Monticello nuclear plant to 2040. We were ordered to go back and do additional modeling a little bit later that year. So the commission required us to submit new modeling that used some different methods and did more sensitivity testing on the size of the Becker plant, as well as a couple of different technology types that we might be able to employ as resource options in our plan. So we submitted a supplemental filing in June of 2020 that presented essentially the same proposed plan, but with new modeling and additional information to the commission. At that point, they started the public comment process. And so we received comments from a lot of members of the public, but primarily several different formal stakeholders in the regulatory process that both submitted their own modeling and alternative proposed plans to ours. And there were other parties that just submitted written comments, essentially making arguments on the merits of the plan or things that they did not appreciate about it. And so in those public comments, we got a significant amount of pushback on the CC. There were parties that presented plans that did not include the CC and said that their plans were much more cost effective than ours, but they also didn't include the firm dispatchable resources we knew that we needed to maintain reliability. And so when we received all of those comments, we went back and decided to analyze whether we could have a reliable and cost-effective plan that did not essentially require the CC to be built. And that was the alternate plan that was filed in June 2021. In that filing, we did provide a comparison between both the business as usual case, the baseline, the previous preferred plan, and the alternate plan to show what the costs would look like under that updated modeling. And the costs, it clearly showed that on a cost basis, the alternate plan was much more cost effective. And so that's essentially how we sort of got to that point. It's true that in the 2021 filing, we presented both plans to the commission, but as Mr. Evans mentioned, by the time we got to the hearing, we had worked with stakeholders to propose particular decision options for the commission to choose from, that we encouraged them to select the alternate plan because we felt that was the best plan moving forward.
Thank you very much. Senator Prince.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks, members. Thanks, Ms. Mandich, Mr. Evans. First of all, understanding the process, I realize you went through a lot. Our questions are on behalf of our constituents, trying to say, let's shed some light on these issues. And I want to start by saying, I'd like to quote Senator Gazelka from last year, who said, our energy should be clean, reliable, and affordable. And I hope this committee takes the clean part as seriously as reliability and affordability. I love serving on the committee. I appreciate the working relationships. And I heard Senator Matthews talk about more increases. Those in my party are very concerned about more increases in wildfires in California and in flooding and in the effects of climate change. And I'm not going to ask you your modeling on climate change, but I just want to have the committee recognize there are those of us on the committee who are very concerned about more increases, including this increase, which I've mentioned on the floor of the Senate. We're now paying hundreds of billions of dollars a year in the United States for insurance claims for climate-related storms. And one thing both parties agree on is that insurance claims and the premiums that they represent come from the public. So the public is paying for the cost of climate change right now, and I'm concerned that there'll be more increases. I think we can expect them in the future. So to the extent that you're trying to decarbonize, I hope that we keep in mind that one of our goals is to be cleaner, and I think the state of Minnesota and Xcel Energy and the PUC are keeping that in mind, and I'm encouraging you to keep doing that. I do have a couple questions, if that's okay, Ms. Mandich, Mr. Chair.
Senator Brent.
Thank you. I guess, first of all, as we talk about the 800 megawatts of dispatchable, that's not until 2027, right?
Senator, that's correct.
Okay, and how do we determine that that's when we think we'll need to figure out what those resources are going to be? Why is it okay for the state of Minnesota to wait till then to figure that out?
Ms. Mandich?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think we would have preferred that the commission had authorized building CTs in their decision in February or in earlier this month. Having said that, though, I don't think we're going to wait until 2027 to make that choice. There are certificate of need processes that we will initiate, I believe, at the end of this year or early next year to essentially start proving out why we believe a CT is the best resource to meet that need for that first unit. And so, you know, building energy infrastructure takes a long time. And so while we think we proved the case, other people did not agree with that. And so we will continue working through those processes and try to prove out what the best technology is through that process.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my other question is, I think questions about stakeholder input, host communities, those are good questions. Is Xcel Energy testifying here today that there needs to be some reform of the way we take stakeholder input? I'm sensitive to listening to all voices. I think all of us are. We all have our constituents. And I mean, is there something about the stakeholder input process which you, Ms. Mandich, or you, Mr. Evans, are saying, hey, this is not working? Or do you feel that the stakeholder input process is about right and we're getting the proper input and giving it the proper weight?
To either one of you?
I'll give that a shot. The answer, I think, simply is no. I mean, we're always looking for ways to improve the regulatory process and particularly to speed it up. And there's a concern, of course, that if you speed things up, you get less input. And so that's, you know, the other side of it. I don't remember the number, 8,000 public comments and 20 interveners. You know, an intervener is someone who formally intervenes, becomes a party, and is able to participate fully as a party in the proceedings, just as a, you know, a lawyer would, or a party in a lawsuit would, and so they get to ask us additional questions and all of that sort of thing. So, I think that's. I don't believe we have any concern about the amount of public input. If anything, our concern is how to do it quicker so that some of these decisions could be made more quickly.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Senator Rents.
Thank you. To be continued on the stakeholder input part. Mr. Evans, I note for the record you twice referred to lawyers and litigation and intervention and juries and all that other stuff, and I'm going to do the committee and everybody here a favor by not taking you up on that discussion so we can get out of here before 4:30. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess just a quick comment on that. I would think the stakeholder process is probably a pretty decent one right now. I think we need to get more people aware of it so that we get a balanced approach and all perspectives brought. I think right now we could say that there's a kind of a one perspective that gets a lot of people involved in the process and other perspectives that people don't get involved. And so I think that's something that just needs to be education for the public. But I want to, as we talked about, it's an unknown source for that one at this point out of 2027, and was part of the reasoning that that was brought back to you this way instead of going forward with either the CC or the two CT options because of potential emerging technologies that they thought might be able to replace that instead?
Ms. Mandich?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, that's part of the question that was evaluated. We had alternative modeling presented from other parties that said they felt that solar plus storage would be a better way to meet that need. That is not what we saw. We had some interesting discussion about how much we think that storage is going to cost and how it can dispatch and for how long. But ultimately, yes, we believe that a CT would have been the best thing to approve at that time, and we will evaluate all of those technologies that are commercially available when we go through the subsequent regulatory processes.
Senator Rarick?
And thank you. And as we talk about these emerging technologies, is one of those potentials that could replace a lot of this, some of the small-scale nuclear technologies that are being worked on and developed?
Ms. Mandich?
Mr. Chair, Senator, as we know here, we have a moratorium on new nuclear plants in the state. I think we're always evaluating new technologies. My understanding is that there are no alternative reactors currently approved that we could build in that time frame. But of course, we are looking at every technology that might be available to us in the future to meet our needs.
Mr. Chair, maybe I could just add an answer to that question. Ms. Mandich made reference to this, but she wasn't specific about the possibility of hydrogen. These plants that we are proposing, the CT plants that we're proposing, would be capable of using hydrogen as a fuel. That does not emit carbon dioxide the way natural gas does. And the problem right now is hydrogen is expensive. And so, but that's one of the alternative technologies that we're looking forward to. If you could burn hydrogen in these plants and produce energy without producing carbon dioxide, that would be then those firm dispatchable resources that would be carbon free.
Sir Rick?
Thank you. And then one last, as I look at the chart on page 5, and we're talking about the resources that we have available right now, and when we look at your 81% in 2030, and you got 26% of that is our current nuclear, and then we also see the wind and the solar, but we know all of that has a life span that is coming to an end, and especially the nuclear. Are you looking, and do you see, are you going to need to rely on new technologies that are going to be emerging over these next couple years to replace that to keep that reliability piece in place?
Ms. Mandich.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, I believe we will have to rely on new technologies in the future years for our plan. We believe that it would be very challenging, if not impossible, to get to 100% clean energy without new technologies that are not available today.
Senator Eric?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm going to close with just a comment. I think, this was something that we brought up last year. There are new technologies that are being worked on. We don't even know what some other potentials are, but we are missing the boat in this state, as was mentioned, when we have a moratorium on nuclear and don't have the ability to even consider them in these plans. And when you look at the small-scale nuclear that is being they're working on developing, that could potentially use the spent rods that still have a lot of energy in them, we are missing the boat in Minnesota on potential carbon-free energy unless we do away with the moratorium very soon. They're going to have to start working on their plans for the future and replacing this without the potential of even thinking about something that could be a solution. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Eric. Comments on that? I guess you've spoken to the moratorium. I just have a couple. If we just go to page 5, and it's sort of a takeoff on Senator Eric. So, you know, beyond the 80 by 2030, certainly publicly, Xcel is out there with a, I think, 100% by 2050. So then I do look at chart, you know, 5, and understanding that if the Monticello plant isn't going to go much beyond 2040, and I think we probably, you don't have to tell me anything, but the Perry Island plant is not going to be either too far behind it, or it's going to go before Monticello, and so now we've lost another 26% out of it. I'm trying to make 100% out of 39 and 13 is 52 and 3. I'm trying to make 100% out of 55%. I guess all we're saying is that, and thank you, Xcel. I mean, you're a leader in the world in terms of your perspective going forward on clean energy. But you have a lot of work to do. Is that true?
Mr. Chair, yes, that is true. I've joked to people, to my friends, that I'm targeting retirement in 2050 when the last ton of carbon goes off the system. And then I'll consider that my job is done. So, yes.
Mr. Chair, I should add, because I think you make a very good point. When we made our announcement a year or two ago about our carbon goals, we tried to be very clear that the 80% reduction by 2030 was achievable with current technology, and that's what Ms. Mandich's plan has shown. But the 100 by 2050 was not achievable. It's been set as a corporate goal. It's something that we all work toward, but it's not, you know, if we had to lay the plan out today, we couldn't do it. And so that is a goal that we pursue, but it's not a goal that we know how to reach. And of course, as Ms. Mandich said, every 3 years we go back and do this over again. New technologies may be available at that time. New options may be available at that time. And that's why we do it every 3 years, because, you know, we can't look at this plan and say, okay, we're all set for 15 years, let's not look at it again, because things are going to change between now and the end of that 15-year period.
Ms. Mandich, Mr. Evans mentioned hydrogen. I'm just curious, and you know, hydrogen sort of an on-fire idea if you look at the world platform in terms of energy and what's being discussed. Within the spectrum of a 15-year plan, was hydrogen even mentioned in your plan? I haven't read it, of course, but perhaps should have. But is hydrogen within your scope of view, at least? I know you've got a pilot project.
Mr. Chair, we did talk about it in the plan. We haven't modeled it in terms of exactly how much we think it would cost yet, because I think at least at this point it's still relatively nascent. It's not a well-developed market, but it is something we're going to be examining going forward in our future plans.
Ms. Mandich, and maybe this is a technical question beyond a resource planner, but if the base fuel for hydrogen is water, which is pretty inexpensive and readily available, what makes hydrogen so expensive?
Mr. Chair, my understanding is that the electricity to electrolyze the water to split it into hydrogen is the primary cost input, you know, in addition to the actual electrolyzer that has to be right. built. So there's a essentially a fuel production cost that has to be considered.
Members, any more questions today? Sensing none, thank you to our guests today. Appreciate it. Very enlightening, at least as far as I'm concerned. I would note we have a couple of public utility commissioners in the audience. Welcome, and please come anytime and keep in touch. So if that meeting is adjourned at approximately 4:05.